Stimulating call. Hello, down to brass tacks.
Good afternoon, Mr. David Ellis.
Yes, welcome.
How are you?
I'm well, and you?
I'm well, too. You had an earlier caller whose ruminations engaged my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I usually don't speak on matters political, since I'm only a theoretician. But what he was saying made interesting stuff to me, and I think, well, let me say you dismissed him. It was a gentleman who was speaking about the transition of leadership that occurred under the Democratic Labor Party from one leader to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in all countries, and David, you know there's policy intrigue.
Of course.
Right. Now, if we start from the beginning, well, let's say the last prime minister and go back, I will strengthen the gentleman's case by saying this. Mr. Stewart, who would be the last Democratic Prime Minister and Labor Party Prime Minister, was seen as holding on for Mr. David Thompson. Correct?
At what point?
Before he died? Mr. Thompson was ill.
Right, before
when
he died.
Thompson was, right. So Mr. Stewart was seen as holding on for him and that he would return eventually. Well, of course, that did not turn. Matters turned out differently. And, of course,
I don't know that your assessment is correct. My recollection of that period is this, that when we discovered that David Thompson was ill and ill enough that Mr. Stewart had to hold on for him, it was well recognized by that time that he had cancer.
And no, David, what I'm talking about is everything has a genesis. So I'm talking about when he came into office as the acting prime minister.
That's the period I'm talking about.
It was seen as by the citizens of Barbados that he was holding on until Mr. Thompson came back, because at that time we were not appraised of the fact that Mr. Thompson's illness was that serious. But it's not something I want to talk about.
Yeah, that's not
right.
Prolong it. Oh.
Right, so if you go back, you remember Mr. Sandiford? When Mr. Sandiford took over at the death of Mr. Barra, there was also, let's call it the subterranean level, just below the surface level, also the talk that he was not the preferred choice, there was another choice, and that there was all this palace intrigue again with persons going into government house and all that. This is in the Barbados that I live. And I know you live in the Barbados. You're an outstanding journalist. These things are talked about. Now, to talk about Mr. Barrow and the transition, then David Thompson, too, I don't know if you recall this, was seen as a young prime minister in a hurry, and that he could wait his chance and that kind of thing. That also occurred in Barbados. That conversation I remember also. But I will put it all together by telling you about something that I observed. You remember when, after Mr. Thompson had suffered two defeats at the hands of Mr. Horn, after he bowed out of politics for a period of time?
I'm aware, yeah.
Right. And Clyde Mascot took over the leadership of the party. Clyde reorganized the party and everything, and they started gaining some traction because he spoke largely on economic matters, which is the bread and butter of all political discussion. And then they started hosting some meetings. They went to St. Philip, and they had a very successful meeting. I remember at that time, David Eswit was like a shining rod or lightning rod. But there was a meeting held at Holders Hill in St. James on a Sunday night. Now, after building up the resources of the party and everything, and I guess Clay would have been feeling very good about himself and what he was doing for the leadership of the party, and party members were feeling good because they were resurging after these two defeats and sort of feeling down the dumps and everything. This meeting was held in Hoarders Hill. And as I said, being the leader, Clay reserved the right to speak last at the meeting. Most leaders close out meetings. Nobody really comes after the leader. But at this meeting, Mr. Thompson was included. But I don't know, because I can only speak as an observer, I don't know how it had been played out when they probably sat to discuss how the evening program would proceed. But lo and behold, when Mr. Thompson made his appearance at about 10 or so in the evening, excuse me, there was a mighty fanfare, you know, like the coming of the king. And there was a huge crowd also that attended the meeting because it was broadcast that Mr. Thompson would be arriving. Mr. Thompson came, he saw, and he conquered. And that was the end of the leadership of Mr. Clyde Mascot. Because when Mr. Clyde Mascot mounted the campaign, the platform to speak, on that night, people were walking away because the refrain was, the real leader come back. So all I call to say I'm not disputing anything, but the gentleman was making some points that if you probably, and I know you do, David, you are leading most senior journalist in Barbados. So you understand palace intrigue, you understand inside party politics.
I'm not disputing that there have been instances of palace intrigue and that sort of thing. And the what you have just put before us cannot be disputed. However, as it relates to the points that he raised, the specific instances that he drew to our attention, I cannot recall, with the exception of that short period when there was the talk about the Eager 11, any significant challenge whatsoever to the leadership of Mr. Stewart thereafter.
Okay.
Right through to the elections.
Okay.
So he was saying, he put down the table and I couldn't identify with it.
Okay, I'm going to go back. Before Mr. Tate passed away, he delivered a public lecture at the, what do you call this place? Oh my goodness, it's in Bay Street. It's there, right there by the Garrison. The Clock Tower. Yeah, that's the name. He delivered a public lecture at the Clock Tower. And it was a fairly good attendance also. And he was speaking about the early years of the Democratic Labour Party. And he essentially spoke to the same thing about the tremendous challenges
But that is not an issue today. I don't, and my question is, so what does that have to do with where we are today?
No, what I gathered from what the gentleman was saying is that, for instance, today we look at our current leader and we call her the undisputed leader of the Barbados Labour Party. What the gentleman was trying to say, that if you look at the linkages and how passage from one prime minister to the next within the Democratic Labour Party fold was handled, he was saying there was always intrigue and pressure basically to hold to your job, so that essentially you had to be, while managing the country, also looking over your shoulder. Now, if you're the undisputed leader, unrivaled...
I don't think that David Thompson had that when he took over.
I said to you that there were people who were saying in the party that he was a young prime minister in a hurry.
Yeah, but...
He could have lined up...
I don't recall that he had that. I don't recall that Mr. Barrow had it. I would say to you that in every political party, you have their aspirants. And therefore, in the period that Mr. Sandiford was there, Mr. Sandiford became unstuck when this issue blew up at the Barbados Tourism Authority, and members of his cabinet didn't feel properly consulted and that sort of thing about what was going on. But prior to that, I wasn't hearing any rumbling about Mr. Sandiford's leadership within the Democratic Labour Party either.
But
I can't really spend a lot of time going back over that. I tell you the truth. That's history that, you know, we could talk about in more detail another time. But, right now, if you're making a comparison here and saying to me that the BLP leadership, when a person is made Prime Minister of Barbados, has an easier time than the DLP leadership, I will say this to you. It may well be that the BLP leadership discover it up better.
Well,
because I can tell you that there were people who were there in the days of Tom Adams, for instance, who could talk about the kind of challenges that he used to get in the parliamentary group and that sort of thing. And I would not fool myself in the notion that having as big a cabinet and a group of people to deal with as Ms. Motley currently does, that she will not have challenges in trying to deal with the various factions within a group as big as that. It is not possible for that to happen.
It comes back to what has been said traditionally across Barbados until very recently, that there's one political party that keeps all of its challenges and all of its issues internally and covers them down well, while there's another one that will float all of the issues in the public domain. And we know quite obviously who we're speaking to in both instances.
Well, I would say to you that prior to the time when Mr. Wainatha took over the leadership of the Labour Party, whenever we heard about a defection from one party to the other, it used to be a defection from the BLP to the Dems. You know, and talk about, but even though you, at the end of the day, you would talk about being able to cover up. But when you get defections like Dark Husbands, and you get defections of, let's say, Elliot Motley leaving to go to become to be a diplomat in New York and that sort of thing. I mean, it used to come across as though it was the Democratic Labour Party that was the winner. And it's only towards, in that period where you had these Wayne Arthur Dems coming across because they were disaffected with the leadership of David Thompson and stuff. And it was an easy way to exploit that. So only in that period did we see that difference. Anyhow.
I'll quickly say, because it's very technical and it can be very broad into discussing. But defections come from two contexts. An individual can also look and see, you know what, I have some skills and talents, and I'm not going to get very far because there's so many people ahead of me. So I probably have a better chance going over the other side when I look over there and look at the skills and talents.
Okay, but let's move on. Thank you very much for coming. At least you can't say dismiss you. Down to brass tacks. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, just two quick little things, right? And I hear that ad all the time with the e-passport. All right, well, 10, 15 times. I'm just trying to, okay, slow it down. What's this guy really saying about this eating? I can't really can't get work out. I mean, he's talking about the biometric data, right? But where you going to put a chip with an antenna in it in a passport? What's the antenna there for? Who tracking you? Well, the government barbers got the information, got the machinery, equipment to track whatever is that antenna is supposed to be identifying. What they got antenna in a passport for? That's the first thing. And the second thing is, what information they got from that chip? Now, he was saying they got the same information as and they go, I can't really hear what he's saying. But I know the photograph goes in there. What they put their fingerprints in that chip there, too. I remember about a year ago, you had a prime minister and cabinet getting out and saying, well, we're going to start taking fingerprints of people who are coming through, except diplomats and somebody else. And it was a problem. You went through the negative resolution process, which meant you put the bill with everything there. And you have, and the other members have a responsibility to see it within a certain number of days. And if you don't comment on it, then it goes through and becomes law. Commissioner challenged it. Ambassador Commissioner challenged the thing. And it stopped. The Prime Minister get in public and say, well, no, we need to do this because the integrity of the passport was being challenged. No, I don't remember you, Mr. Ellis, particularly being perturbed by that particular comment. Because I never knew the Barbados passport ever had any integrity issues. But that whole issue seems to have gone away. That's only about a year ago, and all of a sudden you hear about this chip going into passport with an antenna. Now, I know, the policeman tell me, that when they take your fingerprint, you could do any, you could get accused of pelting a rock across the street. The policeman will grab you in and take fingerprints. It doesn't matter. Once you get accused, they're taking your fingerprints. What are them taking the fingerprints for? Who are they reporting to? The police told me, point blank, they're working for the FBI. Now, I don't know that I pay taxes for the FBI. I pay taxes to the Barbados government to protect me and my interests as a citizen of Barbados with a separate flag and an anthem and everything they say. I'm a separate citizen and that can rely on my government to protect me if I'm in trouble. All of a sudden, now these people working for the FBI? Is that what that chip is supposed to be in that passport? With the antenna? When I'm working for the FBI with that same new passport? Because if that's the case, man, let me tell you, I got to stop here. I don't want the passport. Or I got to find somebody to travel. Somehow that guy that went for the radio program when he explained about the biometric data that's supposed to be going on, might go and come and say something and make it a little more clear. Even if he makes it clear, you got every reason not to trust what it is that he's saying. That's the first thing. Because you go on quiet, so none will say. Okay. Second thing. The red caps. Barbados is the only place where red caps still operate. And I agree with it. I mean, I actually agree when, the Owen Arthur people said, no, you know, they want to remove the red caps and let people come in and just push the carrots as they see, as it is everywhere else in the world, apparently. We got to keep people employed. I agree with it. Keep them employed. Some, you know, technology will take over stuff. But I think they got a government's responsibility to say, but we got to keep people employed. And some things we can accept, and some things we have to really look at, like the Uber thing as well, too. You keep the red caps, let me keep the taxis. If you think it's going to, you know, displace certain types of work efforts, well, so be it. 30 years ago, 28 years ago, software came onto the market. You could put it on your laptop. All that you need to do is to have a nurse. The nurse can take diagnostic information, plug it into the software, and the software will deliver you a prognosis that is as good as any doctor in the world. I'm going back with case histories and everything else, and give you percentage sureties. I am 98% sure this is your condition. I'm 38% sure if it's not that, it's this position, and so on. That's about back in 1992, 1993. And the nurses in England were saying, well, you know, we could use, because doctors are expensive, we need nurses to go through the countryside and offer and provide those people in those areas with the kind of medical support, you know, that would normally have costed the taxpayers the price of a doctor. But we had nurses can do it with the help of this software. The software was squashed. You foolish? You can put in doctors out of work. But that was 28 years ago. That software will never touch Barbados. You can put doctors out of work. Well, you're going to be foolish.
40 years ago, we had conductors on buses.
And the conductors were displaced now because you put the machine. So you could be selective. I think the conductors should still be on the buses, to be honest with you. Because you got to keep people if people are not employed, they are not consumers. The idea is you have to maintain a consumer. Barbados is only a consumer base of about 120,000, 130,000 people. People who can actually go in the shop and buy something. You don't want to displace them. You want to keep them with money in hand. That's what an economy is all about.
But you're only looking at one side of the picture. And I said, and ultimately, it is the service to consumers that must also be taken into account. I mean, you have people here who are putting up a defense for taxi drivers. And there are a lot of good taxi drivers out there. But I get comments in here about people who feel that taxi drivers are not competitive enough, they're not creative enough, and some people feel the rip-off some people too.
No, that's human nature. But you don't think people rip off people too. It's
that,
human nature.
That is possible. Okay. But at the end of the day, you're going to look at what is the service doing for a majority of the people.
Ha! Now we get to my man, Mr. Architect, the guy that called yesterday. 2 points he made, I got to agree with all the time. I mean, I don't agree with him most of the time, but all of a sudden there's a new government and he's saying things, man, that I can't disagree with. Huh? If you're providing a service that for which there really is no remedy, there is a remedy. A service is supposed to provide a remedy for a condition, you know, that you have to experience in life. You know, you go, you want a house clean, you bring a maid to clean your house. You want traveling, you need a taxi person. And yeah, you're right. You know, if the consumer has to benefit in some way, but you got this group of people who get paid anyhow, even though their services are really not required. When you go and get a loan, you got to pay these people for that loan, and all it is just signing on the paper that is more or less a pre-formatted form. You've been getting loans for years. There's no way that people can now come and thief from you because that thing done, that arrangement has been arranged years ago. But you still got to pay two people to get that loan. Huh? Those people need to come up to date as well, too. Every time you go open a business, $2,400, boy. You got to pay $2,400. No, man, it's a pre-formatted form that any JP can come and sign and stamp and say, you got a business deal. No, you got to pay $2,400 and it can't be accounted. It got to be one of them people. Yeah? If you want to go down the road where technology is going to displace certain types of professions, let it work for them there too.
I agree with you, though.
You agree with me?
Yeah.
But I ain't say which profession it is. But
that one is obvious.
You see, the thing about it is that some people operate with protection. I mean, more than any.
Not because you want to strike at any particular profession, but because the ultimate issue is service to the public.
Service to the public. And that service has to be a remedy to some condition. And yeah, if you are ill and you go and visit this guy, he provides you with the service, then you pay him for that service. And that service will be paid based on the time and the effort that he spent.
But you know that we have to make allowance for the fact that in the not too distant future, it is already happening outside of Barbados, but artificial intelligence is actually taking over many functions.
You know, artificial intelligence, I wanted to come to Barbados, but I saw a robot yesterday jump over a log and climb up steps and everything. Dexterity, you know, I don't know. Look, before I go any further, the military, right? We have an army, and the army runs a boat and stuff, and I think that the army is not really providing a service that we actually do need because it's supposed to be defending us from overseas people. Let the army convert them into people that will help to repair the roads in Barbados. Now, let me start doing that kind of thing. we're not displacing people. We're just more or less reorienting them, putting them in areas where we can actually benefit from their particular services. You want to send home stenographers? Don't send them home. The primary schools need stenographers like crazy. They're always short-handed. They need to have things typed up. Move these stenographers out of central government. Well, move them away from the bureaucratic processes and government, put them in the primary schools where they are needed. Things like that, you see, because you're providing services that people actually do need. You're providing that remedy. Now, yeah, the robot can jump over a log and walk upstairs. Artificial intelligence bring it to Barbados. And for one reason, I don't think that anybody that sits and judges me as a human being should be a human being. That person should be beyond me. That's a person that have logic that it can't compete with and
well, I'm
and
not,
come up.
You know you're special, so you
but
need.
But am I going to be special?
You need.
I want the artificial intelligence to replace the bench. Let me stay home, then, people.
You have to look at you. You have to look out for the warning from Professor Hawking, the late Professor Hawking, that the day will come when the artificial intelligence will turn against you.
Well, I think there are certain areas where it could most definitely be deployed.
All right, sir. We got to go. Thank you very much. Down to brass tacks. Hello? You're on the air. Should be able to get, what, two calls or so in here? Are you on the air? Are you there? Yes. So we've covered a wide range of issues here today. I was particularly intrigued by the call about the taxis and what are we going to do about the taxis in the country. And I do recall, I was looking for it just now, but I couldn't find it at all. I saw this piece on the BBC, which talked about the eventual creation of an Uber-like system for mass transit. And the guy was, his thesis was that in the not too distant future, we may very well find that cities are going to move more to that kind of mass transport and rely less on the car. And he then raised the question of whether it is considered to be a preposterous idea, a mixed comparison with, look how quickly we move from horse and buggy to cars. Okay, so that all of those ideas are out there floating around, the possibility that you can find a different approach to our problem, because we have in Barbados to be concerned about the traffic jams and the pollution and the problems attendant on that. Down to brass tacks. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, the taxi. I just got to tell the guy don't panic, because y'all say that you have to use is a credit card or something like that.
A piece of software. But there's a young person here who has created that same kind of Uber-like approach, a concept.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that there's time, and everybody would not have that software. And I think he's saying he's going to fight it, but they need to lobby. They need to get together as a group, and even if government is going to listen, they can have a little limited amount of Uber for the time being. They don't have to.
But we're tourists. Look, we're a tourist-oriented country. If you get enough tourists on the cruise ships in particular complaining about the cost of taxi service or the quality of the service and comparing that with what they get from Uber outside of Barbados, what do you think is going to happen eventually?
Yeah. We also, it's not only for tourists that we have to plan. We have people want to go to weddings. We got to want to go to funerals. I think there's enough that taxi men can also, providing they don't give out many more taxi licenses, benefit from this. And as time goes by, they might even want to, if they see the success of it, they might, as the lady said, they might even want to join. But in the meantime, I think they should have, I am tired of hearing of these groups that there's no cooperation between them and everybody's out there on their own and they don't get together, so anything can happen. I was in town. I bought a small flat-screen TV. I had it in the box. And I went to a taxi driver and asked to bring me out the road. And and the person said $20. I said, good. I took out my $20. I had it in my hand. And when I get near to home, the person tell me, 25.
Why?
I said, so, will you tell me when I was in town? I didn't realize that I had come out of here, but I said, I tell you exactly where it was going though.
Wow.
And then the person came and said, all right. So don't do that to people. Don't tell them one price.
That's ridiculous.
So you do that with a tourist. The tourists are so au fait with what's going on. They travel all around. They travel to a lot of small countries. They get treated in different ways. They get treated good in different ways.
If you didn't protest, you would have had to pay the $25.
But there's no way we're going to give him because he told me 20 in town. And I exactly tell him where it was going, right?
Yeah.
So these are things that
all right.
drivers need to do.
We have to go. Thank you very much for calling. And thanks to all the other persons who participated in today's edition of the program. Thanks to Dennis Johnson as well, the technical operator and producer. I'm David Ellis, wishing you a good afternoon and a pleasant weekend.